You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Hello, hello, hello out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that lift them above the average genre fare. Are you new to us? Well, we would like to welcome you to our strange and unique brand of criticism. Are you returning? Then you know what you're in for, so buckle your seatbelts, because this is our 150th episode.
Wow. Wow.
I know. That's a lot of video and audio.
That is a lot. Yes.
So I turned on my, I can't think of her name from The Fog, Adrienne Barbeau's character. I was turning on my Stevie whatever FM radio voice, which is kind of appropriate because we are on the, not only our 150th episode, but we are in our Christmas spectacular.
Wow, it's Christmas time.
It is. Christmas in hell for you, obviously. Yes. Yeah. I have a Santa Mickey shirt on.
Yeah, well, you know.
And I guess we'll go ahead and we won't release all the film info, but we will let people know that we are doing a very John Carpenter Christmas.
We are. We are. It's going to be a John Carpenter Christmas, and you guys are going to love it. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
One of our,
and you do know, of course, that it is the first film today, which we released a few days back in a promo, and it is Escape from New York.
Oh, yeah. I know that.
Which I thought was a good choice because our technically, our first episode was a John Carpenter film with Kurt Russell in it.
Correct.
And this is a John Carpenter film with Kurt Russell in it.
Yes, yeah. And we say it's our first film. I mean, our first, you know, episode of the podcast. We did a little welcome who we are kind of episode. But I've always thought of The Thing as being our number one episode, you know, our first episode sort of thing. But before we jump in, just genre-wise, I just wanted to say quick, because mine's real quick this week, I finally finished Sandman. I told you a couple weeks ago I started Sandman. I highly recommend it. I think you would like it, too. It is so unique and different and a really good Netflix series. The production design, acting, voice work, it's I highly recommend it. It's good.
Okay. Well, I will have to check it out.
I just finally got to finish it. And mostly I haven't been able to finish it because I've been consumed with another series, which I had to watch all of, which is totally not in either of our genres, but you might like it. It's called First Lady. And it was a Showtime series. And three first ladies all throughout history, all told in multiple storylines, multiple flashbacks, multiple castings, but it's Eleanor Roosevelt. Well, let's go back. It's produced.
One of them's Gillian Anderson.
Gillian Anderson plays Eleanor Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. Unrecognizable. I mean, better than her Margaret Thatcher. It is so good. And Michelle Pfeiffer, again, unrecognizable, plays Betty Ford. And Viola Davis plays Michelle Obama. And those are the three. And it follows their adventure. I almost called it, I was talking to Barbara about it, and I said, oh, so instead of being West Wing, this is East Wing. So it's just the first ladies and what they do and how they changed history kind of thing. And it's a really cool premise. It got horrible reviews, and I don't see why. Anyway, I was obsessed with that. I had to watch freaking 9 hours of that and finally catch up on my last 2 hours of Sandman. So there you go.
It's funny because I've been indulging in all those, and this is not my topic either, but those Marvel series that were on Netflix and Disney Plus. I've watched two seasons of Daredevil, one season of Jessica Jones, and one season of Luke Cage.
You're catching up.
I am burning through those, and I'm actually enjoying them actually a lot more than I thought
Good.
I would.
Daredevil especially, so, he's great. Yeah,
He is great. But my topic for the week, of course, I was down again those corridors of Shudder.
And
I watched a little movie that I watched a little movie that we've talked about in our Coming to Get Shoes, and that is Watcher.
Oh, okay. Yes. Cool.
This movie kind of blew me away. It is not for everyone. I know I say this often on this little program of ours. I am a slow burn horror fan kind of guy, and this movie is very slow and atmospheric. It is directed by Chloe Okuno, who really has not done much more than some acclaimed short films, but man, is she good. There are parts of this movie that remind me of Alfred Hitchcock a lot.
Yeah, it's that voyeur sort of thing, right? Like, it's a Rear Window kind of feel to it, right?
Yes, and a lot of that kind of action is from high-rise windows, but it's two buildings across from each other. Very, very Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly.
And you're witnessing stuff that, A, maybe you shouldn't be witnessing, but B, oh my gosh, now I'm concerned about, and then get scary.
Well, no, this is basically her being stalked.
Oh, okay then.
And she is, what makes it more scary, what adds and intensifies the horror in this, is that she is in Romania and does not speak the language.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she is there because her husband has a job. They move. She was a former actress, and she is currently not doing anything. So all she has time. I mean, all she really does is kind of wander around the city like you would and sightsee and stuff. And she starts feeling like someone's following her. She sees someone across the street from a slightly higher window staring in her at her every night. Yeah, it is really creepy. And of course, you know, the bad stuff's going to happen. Right. This movie stars Micah Monroe. We have been pronouncing her name wrong. I've been switching the K and the I and calling her Makia, but her name is really Micah Monroe. I just discovered that before we were recording this.
And was she It Follows?
It Follows.
Okay.
Yes.
She's awesome. Love her.
She is awesome, and people need to tap into that. She is like right up there with Anya Taylor-Joy and Julia Garner as far as like young female actors on the rise, and as far as I'm concerned. I think she's fantastic. It also stars Carl Glusman, who I don't know, but apparently he's Zoe Kravitz's husband.
Okay.
He plays the husband in this. But then the villain and the person that is staring at her, you will recognize, I think. His name is Bern Gorman.
No, don't remember. But the name is familiar.
He's in The Expanse.
Yep. Okay. As soon as you said it, I went, yep.
And you talk about that all the time. And then he's also in The Dark Knight Rises. The synopsis is a young woman moves with her husband to Bucharest and begins to suspect a stranger is watching her from the apartment building across the street and that he may be the local serial killer who has been decapitating women. So there's a little bit more horror for you. Like I said, it's a slow burn. I highly recommend it. It may not be for those of you that are looking for fast-paced jump scares. However, I did jump twice in this movie.
Interesting.
So, highly recommend it.
I just looked up Bern Gorman. He's also starring in the new Pinocchio movie from Del Toro.
Yeah, and it's animated, I think, because the other Pinocchio movies got Tom Hanks in it.
Geppetto.
Yeah. But anyway, it's on Shudder for those of you that are out there and have Shudder. Watcher from Chloe Okuno and Micah Monroe.
Watch her. That's great. Cool. Well, we can talk about watching something now, I guess, as a horrible segue.
Really, there is no segue.
It's terrible.
It's Romania, New York.
Sort of like big city, don't know what's going on. Yeah, sort of thing. We are jumping all the way
watching
back.
Watching one eye.
Jumping in the Wayback Machine to 1981's Escape from New York. John Carpenter and Nick Castle, directed by John Carpenter, produced by Deborah Hill and Larry Franco. Stars Kurt Russell, Lee Van Cleef, Isaac Hayes, Adrian Barbeau, Ernest Borgnine, Harry Dean Stanton, a bunch of other people that you don't know at all.
A lot of folks.
Just a lot of people in this. Came out in 81, was fairly popular when it came out. A brief synopsis, just so we get that out of the way. In case you haven't watched it, why are you listening to us? Go watch it and then come back. Or maybe listen to us and then you'll want to go watch it, or it'll make you want to watch it again, sort of thing. But the basic storyline, pretty simple premise. I mean, this is like, you know, college film school 101 premise sort of thing, although it has some unique stuff to it. But it's in the future. Crime has become rampant and horrible, so the United States Police Force is formed. They make the somewhat illogical decision to turn Manhattan into the New York City Manhattan Maximum Security Prison. So they mine all the bridges, they patrol all the waters, they set up a police base on Ellis Island with the Statue of Liberty, and every prisoner who's a federal and also, I guess, state prisoner, some maybe, are thrown in there. And basically, you're thrown in the prison and you don't come out, sort of thing. They make, I think, from what I remember of the story, they make monthly food drops, but you don't really find that out really very well in the story itself. But anyway, it's a prison and they just kind of do their own thing. And you try to escape, you die, but you're in there for life and just make the best of it. Good luck. The problem occurs when a plane, Air Force One, essentially containing the president, who's going to a peace summit because obviously the world is at war, is going to a peace summit, suddenly crashes because terrorists have taken control of the plane. They crash it into New York City, which brings back a lot of horrible memories for those of us in 2022. Right. But they crash it into Gotham. The president does survive in a little billiard ball escape pod. And he has with him something that's very vital, a briefcase attached to his wrist that contains a cassette tape of vital...
This movie is 1981.
Vital information. Vital information for the peace of the world. They make the United States Police Force makes a limited rescue mission that doesn't work, so they have to send in someone. They send in a federal prisoner named Snake Plissken.
Snake
is a bit of an anti-hero. He is given 24 hours to get the president out because the president has to get this peace conference with this cassette tape. So Snake is sent in. However, he is also retrofitted, I guess, with two capsules in his neck, which will blow his head off in or open up his arteries in 24 hours. So he has a time frame.
It's an instant aneurysm.
Yeah, instant aneurysm. Snake Plissken, a one-eyed lone warrior, as he's described in IMDb, is sent in to rescue the president within 24 hours, get him out alive, and get him there. And he has to fight through a variety of undesirables and weird people and meet the Duke of New York, who is the reigning, I guess you would call him the gun lord or whatever.
He's number A1.
The warlord of Manhattan. Yes. And he meets various characters on the way, gets captured several times, and eventually we get to the resolution at the end where he becomes pulp culture, you know, cult status anti-hero by what he does at the very end of the movie, sort of thing, which we'll probably reveal as we talk through it because we spoil everything, but you know.
Oh, absolutely.
We saw this. Didn't we see this together in 81?
I didn't see it in a theater, but I definitely saw it on videotape.
I think the first time I saw it was videotape with you. I think that's the first time I saw it too. Okay.
Okay. And then I watched it several times after that.
Okay. I'll just say right from the top, I remember watching this several times. I don't think it's held up very well at all. I really,
really
didn't like this viewing. I was going, is something wrong with me? Am I becoming a grumpy old man or something? I was just going,
you are, because I still love this movie. I think it's fabulous.
I was going, there are things about it I like, but other things that I just cannot buy anymore. I'm just going, no.
Oh, no. It looks great. You just have to let your imagination go and overlook some of that
just
stuff.
Just let art flow over you? Is that what you're
flow
saying?
Over
okay.
You.
All right. All
yeah.
Right.
Yep. I mean, the production design on this shit is really cool. It's all practical. There's no, you know, digital, you know, CGI crap. I will say those moments with the Twin Towers, I had forgotten about. Those are very sobering.
Yeah, even though it's little graphics, computer graphics and everything, but just that, and then seeing the silhouette of the city all dark.
That and his glider landing on top of one.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, that's really dated, because obviously you can't do that anymore, even if you could do it in the first place.
Right.
Also, it starts with Air Force One crashing into a building in New York, which is also very 9/11. So the whole time I was watching this, I was like, man, if people have 9/11 fears or phobias or whatever the word is,
triggers,
they're going to have a hard time watching this. Triggers,
yeah.
They're going to have a hard time watching this. I still love the movie, though. It's funny. When you were talking about characters, you know, when you were talking about Snake or you were talking about the Duke, I could hear the music in my head.
Okay, well, a huge plus to this movie and something I love is the theme. The theme song by Carpenter is great. I don't necessarily like the rest of the music. I think he did better in The Thing. Well, that was Basil Paul Doris, but I think he did better in Halloween with the secondary and third themes kind of thing and the action scenes and all that, and it doesn't work in this one, but I love that opening theme. And so electronic, so 80s, so cool. It's just really neat because it sounded like a spy movie to me. I've got that in my notes. To me, this is not so much a science fiction movie as because science doesn't really propel the story. But it is an action movie, you know, set in a dystopian slide, you know, pseudo world sort of thing. But the music sounds like a James Bond movie. You know, it sounds very kind of sneaky, spy, cool. You know.
One of my memories from it is, and this shows how many times I probably have seen it with you, is that I remember what you don't like the most about this movie.
Which is what?
Is the scene where he's in the fighting ring.
Oh my God, that's so terrible. It's terrible.
Yeah, it's like they took a pause in the story and inserted an action scene.
For no reason.
And then
it doesn't propel the story in any way. As a matter of fact.
Not really.
As a matter of fact, I have it in my notes. It occurred to me while I was watching it this time. And again, I'm saying, am I becoming an old, jaded, you know, grumpy old curmudgeon?
Which you've been saying that since I've known you, so that's not an old thing. Yeah, you've been saying that a long time.
But I remember watching an episode of Big Bang Big Bang Theory, and they are getting ready to watch Raiders of the Lost Ark. And Sheldon's girlfriend says, oh, Raiders of the Lost Ark, that's that movie where the hero guy in it makes absolutely no difference to the plot at all, right? And they all look at her like, oh, how could you say something bad about Raiders of the Lost Ark, one of the greatest movies ever made, and geeks love it, and dun-dun-dun, Harrison Ford, and she's going, no, I mean, think about it. And then through the rest of the episode, they keep coming up with these little things where they're going, that's right. If Indy hadn't been there, this would have still happened. Indy had no influence on this at all, you know, kind of thing. And dun-dun-dun, there's this great action sequence, and yet the same thing that would have happened without the action sequence still happens, sort of thing, right? And this kind of made me feel like that in a way. Snake, this guy with the great entrance. I mean, getting out of the plane and he's handcuffed and he actually leads the guards, you know? Mm-hmm. And then that great first scene with Lee Van Cleef and the cigarette and he's the, I don't want, you know, and he's got the voice. He's got the Clint Eastwood-y kind of thing and all that. But he literally doesn't really do anything good in this movie. Not good, meaning morally good. Just he's not very good at what he's doing. He's just, I mean, really? He's not the expert at anything.
Yeah. Okay. They picked him because he flew the something into Leningrad. It was like a glider type machine, and they needed somebody to do the same thing into New York, mm-hmm. someone with that skill. They didn't pick him for his skills to be a spy or to rescue presidents. They picked him because he's a soldier that knew how to fly in.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah, they took a gamble on him.
Yeah, there's that. Yeah.
I mean, that's what my impression of it was. He flew the something over Leningrad. He says it. Lee Van Cleef says it.
Yeah, too. Because they keep referring to that aircraft, whatever they call it, you know.
Right.
The Nimbus 1 or whatever, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
And I'm guessing it was a glider or something of that nature because he's in a tiny little plane.
Yeah.
It looks like one of those balsa wood ones you have when you're a kid.
Well, it literally is a glider. That's why I was thinking, okay, then how is he ever going to get back? But then again, thinking about it's the World Trade Center. So if he left from the top of the World Trade Center, he probably could glide to Ellis Island. So that still works kind of thing. It's just that they also show him like taking off like it's an airplane and he couldn't take off. It's a glider. You'd have to pull it by something.
Well, they do pull it.
Do they pull it? Did I miss that?
Yeah, it's on a string and like another, something pulls it up into the air and then he releases.
So.
What I was wondering when I watched him get in it, I was like, is there room for the president in there?
Thinking
there's not
the
room
same
for
thing.
Anybody else because that's a two-seater.
I was thinking the same thing of he's the only person in there. It's a single-seater kind of thing. I don't know where he's going to put the president. And then is he intentionally leading these people on, like Brain and Maggie and everybody else, knowing that he's just going to leave them at the top of the World Trade Center and just go, sorry, there's no room, or whatever, you know, and leave them there? I don't know. That's the other thing, too, and I struggle with this one because I remember loving Snake Plissken. I remember loving that kind of blue, weird camo pants and boots and the tank top. And he was just so cool with the hair. It was Kurt Russell, you know. He was like MacReady's evil twin, you know, kind of thing. I used to love that. And I used to love the fact of, you know, he dicks him at the end. But I'm kind of going, did he really? I mean, I'm not really sure. And why did he really? Just because the president was not a nice guy? It's just...
He dicks him in the end because they almost killed him.
He made it back? Like, we didn't think he'd make it back. You know, it's kind
of... And they had to neutralize the explosions in his arteries to keep from having an aneurysm. He was pissed off. The whole time, they stressed him out because he only had 18 hours to get in and get out.
When James Bond, no matter what actor plays him, when James Bond or Arnold Schwarzenegger or Harrison Ford, you know, Indiana Jones, whatever, is deactivating the bomb, do we really think they're not going to deactivate the bomb? Do we really think they're not going to make? Is there suspense that they won't make it? You know, this movie makes a huge issue with a freaking clock. I mean, he looks at it like literally every 5 minutes. So much so that if he hadn't done it the last two times, I wouldn't bitch as much. But okay, you're going to run up 50 flights. 50 flights you're getting up to get to the elevator, to get to the top of the World Trade Center. And you got an hour before you have to be across the bridge and on the other side. And I'm going, there's no freaking way. There is
it's
no
a small island.
Way. Yeah.
Manhattan's not that big. If you're going to start trying to bring logic in, there's no way. I'm like, why do they have electricity? Why would the elevators work?
I agree with that. You know, they keep saying they figured out how to make steam. Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
You know, and they make some kind of fake gasoline.
Yeah. Are the big
one. The cars work.
The big one you thought about even, you know, when we were back in the 80s watching this, is why don't they just blow up the bridges? Why would you mine the bridges?
Why wouldn't you blow them up?
You know, that way you never have to worry about it. I guess they could create,
so they could lead by example. Don't try to escape. You will get blowed up.
Right. They have to have a, yeah. It'll blow you straight up. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, you're fine. I was going to see if there's any scenes in this movie that stick out to you. The one that sticks out to me immediately is in the picture behind me with the dude showing the Lee Van Cleef character, Hawk, that they indeed have the president, and he unwraps a little cloth with the president's finger in it and the presidential ring on the finger.
That character's name is Romero. And he actually is one of the highlights of this movie, in my opinion, still. And he's also, that is one of my scenes as well, is that whole, you know, if you're not in the air in 30 seconds, he dies. If you hurt me, he dies. You know, and it's just boom, boom, boom. You know, kind of.
But wait a minute. Awesome. Yeah, but wait a minute. 17, 16, 15. Yeah. 15.
Okay, everybody in the air. Everybody in the air. Yeah. And, you know,
he's fabulous.
His death is almost good, too. You know, it's one of the better deaths in the movie, so to speak. Really good character. The opening prologue, I always like a sci-fi prologue. I'm big into that. I even like an action movie prologue like Hunt for Red October, you know, where it spells out something.
And it puts the, and it tells, like, what happened in what year.
You know, Blade Runner. It's, you know, it was the year, it's 2085, you know, whatever, da-da-da, you know, all that kind of stuff. except Blade Runner, I think, it's 1987, I think, is what Blade Runner says. But, you know, I like a crawl, and with Carpenter's music, it was good. It was weird this time. It struck me, I was going, why did he pick a female voice to do that?
Because it's Jamie Lee Curtis.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I did not. That's a good trivia. I did not know.
It is. I was going to say it in casting, but yeah, I thought I'd spoil it.
Interesting, because, you know, it seems like, especially with as dystopian as he's saying, you would want that to be a male voice. You know, crime is rampant.
Or in the time period this film was made.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
I think the first scene with Brain is a good scene. It's weird. It's strange enough to be cool. First of all, we've met Adrian Barboub by then, and then we.
How dare you?
again, my old age showing, because I'm looking at this movie going, okay, you're one of the few women we have seen in New York, and you dress like that? That seems really. this is an island of criminals. And you dress like that? It seems like you're kind of inviting bad things.
Hey, she knows what she's doing when she gets a gun, though.
She's very apt. Although, well, not really, because she fires like all seven shots in your six loaded revolver and doesn't stop the car. It still crushes her. Just saying.
Oh, Nick, you have to let these things flow over you.
Anyway. But I liked that scene. I liked Stanton's character and her, and they're in her play.
You're talking about Brain. Yeah.
Yeah. And Brain. And that's pretty cool. And then, of course, you know, you can't, you know, like this movie and not like the last scene, just the way Snake does the whole walk away. And the president is getting made up and he's still being a dick the way he is and everything else. And Snake just kind of takes it all in and then just walks away. We hear the broadcast start. We hear the music, the tape supposedly starting. It's the music from Cabby. Mm-hmm. And he's pulling out the tape, you know. And I just picture Lee Van Cleef running after him with pencils, you know, trying to stick them in there and redo the tape so they can get it back, you know, or whatever.
I was going to ask you this, and I could be just having a brain fart, but he's a great, great anti-hero. I cannot recall one before him. Can you?
Well, it's based on all the anti-heroes of Clint Eastwood. So all the, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
I was going to say a Western maybe. And obviously he based it on Clint Eastwood. I just couldn't remember if Clint Eastwood was an anti-hero in those characters, in those movies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's the come into town, not say a word, and kill when he needs
but
to.
But he's the good guy.
He ends up being the good guy, but he's technically an anti-hero in that he's not standing up for anything moralistic or huge or defending the, you know, it's not like his character in Unforgiven when he's defending the prostitute that was mangled and mauled, you know. He is doing his own thing his own way.
Okay.
Kind of thing. And that to me is a
I just know it's really popular now, and I just didn't remember it being as popular then.
I think you're right. I don't think it was as popular then, and it was a kind of a Western-specific genre trope. You didn't see an anti-spy hero kind of thing.
Well, and that makes perfect sense, because when we talk about John Carpenter and his influences, they're all Western, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, even in this one especially, I mean, using Lee Van Cleef, come on.
For sure. Uh-huh. Any other scenes?
Those are my scenes. What about yours? You know?
Well, I mentioned the one with Romero. I mean, I just like a lot of Dean Cundey's cinematography. I mean, this movie was shot in St. Louis, and it looks like fucking New York. I mean, there's only like two shots in this movie that are actually from New York.
Correct. And those were on Ellis Island, not in the streets of New York.
Right.
All the streets. And yeah, and he's got the added burden of the majority of this movie is at night. So
exactly.
You've got to light it. And they have to kind of throw out the idea of, well, some of the places, you know, because I think, what's his name? I like the actor who plays him, the guy that has the most dialogue at the beginning of the movie. He's the first one
Tom
you see.
Atkins.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, he says, you know, some of the places even have electricity. Some of the streetlights even work. Blah, blah, blah. You know, he had to throw that line in because we have to light something other than firelight. You know.
Yeah, his character's name is Remy, but it's Tom Atkins from The Fog and from Halloween 3.
Yeah.
He's been
and I've always liked
Creep
him.
Show.
Yeah, he was a good 80s actor. I think he was good, and he was always that kind of support role. Going back, Dean Cundey, who has worked with Carpenter on several movies and everything else, and he's got such a distinctive style, What's a great cinematographer, great with lighting. You know, when Snake goes inside buildings, the way he lights it with him like going from shadow to dark and shadow to light, and then firelight over here on one side. You know, just great lighting, good cinematography, nice color. The only thing I thought was odd was, again, the way it's just edited and shot. I don't understand the timing at the end. You know, has it been an entire day? Is it not an entire day? It's supposed to be 24 hours, yet we never saw really daylight. You know, I mean, was it only 18 hours and now it's dawn? But then as a matter of fact, in one shot, they show dawn and then they suddenly cut to the bridge and they're racing across it and it's at night. And I'm going, I'm confused. But
yeah, it's a little dark.
And I just think there's missed opportunities. You know, I would love to have seen this a little bit more. A key for me is a little bit more like The Warriors. Even as cliche as some of The Warriors is, I would love to have seen these cults a little bit more culty. You know, I would like to see the crazies even more, because they were creepy. That was a good scene. I hadn't thought about the arrival of the
crazies.
They're
coming up out of the manholes. I thought so too. Yeah. I was going to mention that, especially
that
with the music.
Nice and creepy. And, you know, he goes into Chock Full of Nuts and he almost has a relationship with this girl or whatever. And then she's blown away. That whole thing, I thought that was pulled into the floor. I thought that was cool and creepy. You know, when they say, don't take, you know, go straight down Broadway. Oh, no, you can't. Or, yeah, go straight. It would have been neat to see that as a different cult clan, even if they're all dressed like baseball guys. No, I don't know. But you know what I mean? A little bit more of a costume and affectation group of these different groups that are living
tribes.
On this. Tribes. Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Should have thought of that word.
I thought that it would have been interesting if they would have maybe brought more conflict in with the crazies instead of having that gladiator scene.
Yes.
Like, maybe there's conflict with the crazies and the Duke's guys as well.
Or even more of the Duke. What makes him the Duke and the ruler?
He's
and
a
the
number
good
one
guy.
Man.
You know, how does he involve his people or politically work his people? You know, that kind of thing. What's his gag? Because he has brain in his pocket? And that is kind of his power trip or whatever. I would love to have seen a scene or a couple of scenes about that rather than the gladiator bad baseball bat fight kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which was just odd. Just still
it was very odd. It's like an intermission almost.
Yeah.
It's very strange. I still love this movie. I thought it was going to look bad when I watched it, and it still looks good to me, and I'm sure Cundey has a lot to do with that as far as lighting. Mm-hmm. Also, you and I harp on all the time about movies pre-CGI, so we love the practical. effects.
Yeah.
And the way things look. And this movie's not pretty, and it shouldn't be pretty, other than lighting.
Yeah.
Anything else that you want to talk about before we move on to cast?
No, I think that's the big thing for my, I'm trying to look at my notes.
I've got some background. Actually, I've got some background notes.
Okay.
They approached John Carpenter after the success of Halloween in the Fog to make a film on a novel that they had acquired. That's Avco Embassy, called The Philadelphia Experiment. And John got stuck on the project and then proposed this idea instead. This was an idea that he and Nick Castle had been kicking around since Watergate. It's very anti-establishment type
idea. Yeah, government is bad. Because
the distrust of government because of Watergate. That's where this whole thing came from.
Mm-hmm.
It had a $7 million budget, but the opening weekend took $9 million in. So he had another hit. This was like his third hit in a row after The Fog.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of cool. It, like I said, it was mostly shot in St. Louis, except for that shot on Liberty Island. They were the first film crew to ever shoot on Liberty Island.
Oh, that's cool.
With the Statue of Liberty. And I think it's kind of cool how it's their base. They have, you know, that's where they bring Snake in and set him up for success, if you will.
Give him some incentive.
Yeah. But the original idea was written between 1974 and 1976. So, and as a result, he could have been, I keep reading that he could have been the director of the Philadelphia Experiment, which I know I've seen, but probably not since I saw it with you on videotape. I don't remember that movie being very good.
I don't remember it being very good. I remember it having some really cool practical effects because, you know, it materializes and people are like inside bulkheads and all of that because it was basically them experimenting with nuclear particles to the extent that they created almost like a time rift or a time portal kind of thing, shifting, phasing matter kind of, you know, Star Trek terms. But, I seem to remember it not because it was like, isn't that Michael Paré, I think, is the lead in that?
I think he's the lead, but I couldn't tell you who directed it. I
vaguely remember it. But yeah, so it didn't imprint like this one did. This one had a lot more impression.
No.
But again, I mentioned that I think The Fog is a lot better. The Fog is a lot better.
Okay. I mean, I love The Fog, too. You're not going to get an argument from me there. I mean, I'm a Carpenter fan, despite his flaws.
I agree.
Now, I do feel like he got to a point to where all of a sudden his stuff was just not good.
Yeah.
But up to a point, it has a Carpenter signature, I would say.
Yes.
And this movie's got it.
I agree with
for
that.
For sure. I mentioned Nick Castle was the co-writer of it. Do you know who Nick Castle is?
Wasn't he in Halloween?
He is the Shape.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. He is Michael Myers in that first movie, at least the first one. So anyway, that's a good segue, I guess, to go to casting. I mentioned that the opening narration computer voice is Jamie Lee Curtis. She went uncredited for that. Mm. Adrienne Barbeau and John Carpenter were married at the time this movie was released. But did you know that Kurt Russell and Susan Hubley were too?
Susan Hubley? Yeah, I knew he was married to Susan Hubley, but I don't remember her. She's not in this movie, is she?
Yeah, she's the woman in Chock Full of Nuts.
Oh, really? I see. I didn't even recognize her.
Mm-hmm. And she gets a billing that says special appearance by Susan Hubley.
Yeah, well, hey, can we cast our wives, please, in this? What is this?
Well, obviously, him and Carpenter were friends. They had done the Elvis movie together at that point. And they were probably doing pre-production stuff on The Thing. It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, maybe.
All right, Kurt Russell. Let's talk about Kurt Russell. Woo-hoo! His performance was, as you mentioned, based on Clint Eastwood. That's why he always whispers, "Call me Snake."
The name's Plissken.
Do you know who studio executives wanted for the role? And I think he would have been good too.
No.
Tommy Lee Jones.
Mm, yeah. I don't think he would have been as action-y as this, you know?
Even well, back he would have been a lot younger. You got to remember that.
Agreed, but even back then, I think, you know, his mystique is much more of a Lee Van Cleef type character than...
Yeah, than, bossy.
Than Snake.
For sure.
But and I can understand why they might have had some hesitancy. I mean, because, I mean, I think at this point, other than Elvis, wasn't Kurt Russell just the Disney kid?
He was a Disney kid trying to shake that image. He was 30 years old when he made this movie. And John wanted him, and he fought for it because studio executives pressured Carpenter to get a seasoned tough guy. And their suggestions were Chuck Norris, Nick Nolte, Tommy Lee Jones, or Charles Bronson.
Golly, no, I don't like any of those. But yeah, Kurt Russell was much better just because there's just something about Russell. He's really good. He's built, he's got a great physique to him that doesn't look too overblown or whatever. Right. You know, he's not too muscular. He's not a Schwarzenegger or something like that.
Well, he's also good looking. He's a lot better looking than any of those guys I mentioned, really.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Except maybe Nick Nolte when he was young. I don't know.
No, but much better looking, got a great attitude to him. I mean, I remember Kurt Russell. I think the first thing I ever saw him in was Computer wore tennis shoes, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he's done so much. I mean, I watched a lot of those Disney movies, too. So many that I can't even remember them all. I mean, because he did a bunch, I'm sure. He was kind of like the male equivalent of Jodie Foster.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Very much so. And then look at their career. That might be cool to pair them sometime and look at their careers and what they've done.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
Because he went on to
Carpenter
do Thing,
dismissed. Yeah.
Big Trouble in Little China, all that in the 80s, right? That was still in the
80s. Carpenter.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Carpenter dismissed Bronson particularly because he was too old. Charles Bronson was 60 when they were wanting to put him in this role.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Nick Nolte and Jeff Bridges were both approached to play Plissken, but weren't interested. However, Bridges went on to do Starman with Carpenter and won an Oscar, or was nominated. No, he was nominated for an Oscar. And Kris Kristofferson was considered for a candidate, but he wasn't approached because of the failure of Heaven's Gate. So there's a lot of people were kind of in line for this.
Yeah.
You know, that's why Kurt Russell had to fight so hard to get it. And Carpenter too, because he wanted Kurt in the role.
Makes sense. Makes sense.
Because he had worked with Kurt and he knew Kurt could do it. Supposedly, obviously, based it on Clint Eastwood, but he based it on two other people. Do you want to know who they are? You're going to love it.
Sure.
Bruce Lee and Darth Vader. Oh, and there was one other, an exterminator character from a movie with Robert Ginty called The Exterminator. I don't remember that movie. Do you know that movie?
No.
I don't know it. Anyway, I just think it's kind of funny. I want to be Clint Eastwood, Darth Vader, and Bruce Lee. So he wished he could have done some of those.
See, I'm not seeing the other two at all. He does no martial arts in this, so there's no Bruce Lee. And he's not a villain controlling character, so I don't see the Vader. I mean, that's just, okay, well, whatever. I mean, whatever makes it work for you as a performer.
Whatever makes it work, and it does work. I mean, he did a sequel, obviously, 20 years later, but it wasn't as good as this.
No.
No way. Nowhere near as good.
No.
Because that was when Carpenter was doing bad movies.
Yes. That's the edge had gone off. Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Lee Van Cleef played Hawk, the guy that basically forces Snake into New York. He was flown in from Los Angeles for a one-night shoot.
Wait.
He has a lot of scenes in the
beginning
of
his
scenes
were filmed in one night?
Yeah.
Wow.
And he was flown out the next day, and John Carpenter watched the dailies and discovered that some of the close-ups were out of focus, so he was forced to use those in the movies, if you know.
I noticed that. It was a couple of those. I was going, okay, that's weird for Dean Cundey because he's usually so good. Yeah. Why is that out of focus?
And I meant to look at how old Van Cleef was when he died, because he was maybe – I don't know if he was in good health when he made this movie or not. I don't remember seeing him anything else after.
Well, again, he's got a great arrival character. You know, character arrivals are so important when you write a screenplay. You know, the first time you see him, how do you see him? You know, Indiana Jones comes to mind. It's, you know, the way he's revealed is such a great appearance in a movie. And Van Cleef's is strong. You know, the helicopter comes in, circles the Statue of Liberty, lands, and he steps out and lights up a cigarette. You know, and the guy runs up to him and goes, "We got an issue." And he goes, "What is it?" And he walks off. You know, that's just
and
a what's, great.
What cracks me up is he's got that big gold hoop earring. Yeah. I'm like, Lee Van Cleef has an earring? Yeah. That is so crazy. I've never seen him like this before.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, and, you know, he's got great scenes with Snake. There's some good chemistry there. But man, that would have been a hell of a night shoot to get all of those in. Because he's got the whole climax, too. With
well, he's got all the introduction stuff and then all the, what do you call those, that they insert in, those little scenes they insert in at the end.
Well, and all the walkie-talkie stuff.
That's what I mean. Those little
The intercuts. Yeah, the intercuts.
Yeah, exactly.
And the whole ending, you know, of him against the wall there, you come and kill me, Snake. You know, and he's got the cigarette and he's, not yet. Yeah.
So, I mean, Carpenter works fast, man. He had all that set up to do in one night.
Wow. That's impressive.
That is impressive, I think.
Yeah.
This movie, I didn't lead off with this, is filled with people. I mean, there's a lot of great people in this movie. One of them is Ernest Borgnine, who plays Cabby.
Yeah.
This character was originally written for Mickey Rooney.
See that? Yeah.
I could see it, too. I think they did well in casting Ernest Borgnine.
Well, and I've got a huge key about that when we get to it. So.
Okay. Keys. Okay. Donald Pleasance plays the President of the United States.
Yep.
He clearly is British. Has a British accent.
Clearly is, yes.
But they said something about this being more of a global community now, and that it would be okay if you were British and the United States president. I don't know. They just made up some background story. And it was pitched to him as being the love child of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. So I'm sure he got a kick out of that. And I will watch Donald Pleasance in anything because I just think he's fabulous. And he had all his props, you know. He didn't have to invent props. They gave him props.
Oh, like yeah.
A briefcase and things.
A watch.
Isaac Hayes plays the Duke. And I see that Cadillac with the chandelier.
Right.
But I don't recall Isaac Hayes in anything other than South Park. What else has he done?
Well, I mean,
I guess he's done.
Prior to this, he was music, right? He had done Shaft. He had done the music to Shaft.
Oh, yeah. He's a huge soul music guy.
And I think that's where he
realized he was an actor.
Well, I didn't either. You know, I think this may have been his first or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I didn't do enough research on cast-wise.
Yeah, I didn't really look into his other stuff, but I like him. I loved him on South Park when he was on South Park.
Oh, yeah.
Season Hubley, I mentioned, play the girl in Chock Full of Nuts. But then we come to the brain, and we have another genre favorite, Mr. Harry Dean Stanton.
Alien, baby. Alien. He'll always be known for Alien.
You want to know who was originally set to play this but got sick and couldn't?
Who?
Warren Oates.
What? Oh.
I don't really see that, but he is another Western actor.
Yeah, and I could have seen it if he was a little bit crazier. Brain is played really straight by Harry Dean. If he was played with a little bit of an edge, kind of crazy, I could see Warren Oates doing that. Yeah.
I always think of Warren Oates in Stripes as the sergeant.
Yeah.
You know?
He is
he's more of a Frank Sutton type.
Sergeant Hulka is our big toe. Yeah.
Warren Oates, though, since he was sick, is the one that recommended Harry Dean Stanton. So they were friends.
Oh, that's cool.
And apparently Oates died later that year of a heart attack. So he must have just filmed Stripes, too, because that came out in 81 as well.
Okay.
Moving on, another Carpenter staple, Adrienne Barbeau plays Maggie.
Mm-hmm.
She was the voice of the computer in The Thing, if you remember that.
Yes, that's correct.
And she also was Stevie, what's her name, on the FM radio in House of the Fog.
The Fog, baby, yep.
Which I love. So I don't have anything else on her. You mentioned Tom Atkins plays Remy in the beginning. He is another standard Carpenter player. I love these directors that stick with their cast. Hear that, Mike Flanagan?
Hear that, Mike Flanagan? Yep.
Another one that he uses in a lot of his films is Charles Cyphers, who plays the Secretary of State.
Okay.
I don't have a picture of him, but you would recognize him. He's the guy that is the weatherman in The Fog that Adrian Barbeau is in contact with. They're in separate buildings across town from each other.
Okay.
He is also the cop that is Nancy's father in Halloween that almost catches them smoking pot when he pulls them.
Oh, okay. Over. Okay.
You remember that?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So that's who Charles Cyphers is, if you don't recognize him right away. Romero was played by some guy named
Frank Doubleday. I know him.
Frank Doubleday.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, he died young. I saw something about him not being around anymore, which kind of surprised me. But he's great. He reminds me of like a Cronenberg actor, like that guy that played Frank Dodd in Dead Zone.
Yeah, I did some research on him just because I liked him. He stood out, and I already knew Kurt Russell and everything else. He was in Assault on Precinct 13. He's the warlord in Assault on Precinct 13.
And he's the one that shoots the girl in the head.
Yes. Yes. he went on, I found out in research, after this movie, he went on and had a huge acting teacher business in L.A.
Oh,
if you trained with Frank Doubleday, you were a really good performer kind of thing, an actor, and learned a lot from him sort of thing, especially in the 80s and 90s. But then he died mid-90s?
Oh, no, I take that back. He just died. He died in 2018.
18, yeah. But he quit
acting in the 90s. That's what it was. I was like, why did he quit acting? I guess maybe he was teaching.
Yep, he had a big teaching career. So, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So, I don't know why I was thinking he died young, but I guess I meant his career died young. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's all I have for casting. I have a little bit award-wise. Our friends at the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror nominated it for Saturn Awards. It was nominated for Best Science Fiction Film, Best Director, Best Costumes, and Best Makeup of 1982. It did not win, though. And that's the only thing I have as far as awards. And it did not make the 1001 movies you must see before you die. And I'm noticing a lot of our choices this year have not. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, true.
So far this season. So we're diving deeper into the cadre of science fiction and horror movies. But
yeah,
I like this movie.
Well, and my last negative, I guess, comment would be I think the audio dubbing in this really doesn't hold up and is really bad. I was trying to, the gunshots don't sound good. Some of the timing doesn't work. There are times when, like, Snake's being led to the gladiatorial combat by, the three guards, and you're hearing the clicks of their heels, like, oh my gosh, this is a silent hallway. They pull back the drape, and suddenly there's 300 people cheering for this big fight. I'm going, where the hell did that come from? Why is that, Jesus. It seems like
it
I would have heard that coming. Or did they go, shh, don't say anything until they get to the door. It's a surprise party for Snake. And then I also I've got in my notes, all right, why are they all cheering Snake, Snake, Snake when he wins? They don't even know this guy from anything.
Oh, sure they do. Everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Word spreads on Manhattan Island.
They thought he was dead. That's right.
Exactly.
Okay.
But no, the thing is at one point, there is one of the characters, I think, says, yeah, we knew you were here or something. Okay. I want to say it was. It's not maybe it's Ernest Borgnine. I can't remember.
And then I do commend Carpenter for killing everybody, basically. I mean, he kills Cabby first with the bad mortar. Then he kills Brain with another bad mortar. Maggie has a great death. The Duke dies. And I remember you loving that whole, oh, you're the Duke. The president is shooting him over and over and over again.
You ain't number one. Yeah, and it's crazy ass Donald Pleasance, man. Yeah, British accent. I think he may even still have the handcuff on his hand or whatever. It's hilarious.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And you know, and then Snake essentially condemning the whole planet to war and die
by just pulling the tape out. Yeah.
So I liked all that.
Back to your everybody dies. Did you notice anything in particular about that? That everybody dies? Everyone that dies?
They all die in the order that he meets them?
No. No. Everyone that dies says, I heard you were dead.
So now they are. Yeah.
So now they are. Yeah. I just think that's kind of cool. I have one other trivia thing that you're going to love.
I have a trivia, and it's probably the same one.
Okay, you go.
No, you go ahead. You do.
About the shot that flies over the helicopter shot over Central Park?
No. What's that?
The helicopter flies over Central Park. When you see that scene, it was actually filmed in San Fernando, California. And the buildings in the backdrop were painted by someone you love.
Oh, he also painted the nighttime. That's my trivia. But he also painted the nighttime silhouette of Manhattan. Those are matte paintings done by our very own beloved James Cameron.
James Cameron. Yes. Apparently, Roger Corman did a lot of the behind-the-scenes work on this movie, effects-wise, his company.
And some of those are awesome. The landing of the glider on top of the landing of the glider, and you can see Ellis Island in the distance all lit up. That looks really cool. And it's great for practical effects.
And it's
effects.
A miniature.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It really, that's another reason why I love the movie. I just think it looks really, really cool.
Yeah.
And then this is kind of a key, but I put it in my trivia because it's not really. But a la Evil Dead, Sam Raimi, because we know that that scene where they're driving through the woods, he actually filmed in a garage and they're like rocking the car in the dark. You know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
And it's not outside at all. It's inside a building.
Oh, yeah.
They do that as well with this. This involves J.J. Abrams. Do you know this?
No.
Okay. The shot of Maggie's corpse under the Duke's car was added after principal photography was done because Carpenter felt the audience wouldn't get it that she'd been killed by the impact.
Uh-huh.
Carpenter and Adrian Barbeau filmed this shot in their garage under their own car. So they just bloodied her up one weekend and stuck her under a car in a dark garage and made that shot to intercut in the rest of the film. Well, that's very Sam Raimi to me. You know, you had always told me he did with Evil Dead.
Oh, yeah. And it's a great shot. Great blood. She looks good. I loved her eyes open. It was nice. It was a good shot.
All right. Well, there's more. During a 2011 interview with Terry Gross on her public radio program, Fresh Air, J.J. Abrams said that as a teenager, he was the first to suggest to Carpenter that Maggie's death was unclear. Abrams, whose father was a movie producer, got to see an early rough cut of the movie, and when Carpenter asked the small screening audience for notes and suggestions, the 15-year-old Abrams told him that he needed to put something in there to establish that she was definitely dead.
Well, thank you, J.J.
Small world, huh? I think that's fabulous.
Whereas everything else he works on, he adds things that the audience never gets an answer to. So...
Well,
yeah, that's interesting. That's cool. I did not know that at all. That's kind of cool trivia. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, and the reason I kind of subclassified it as a key is the whole Sam Raimi thing, because that's what they reminded me of.
Of course.
Shooting extra scenes in garages.
Yeah. I mean, key elements influenced by, yes, of course.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of keys, I guess we could move on into that direction if you're ready.
I have, ironically, for this movie, I have about a dozen keys, so I've got a lot.
I have a few myself. Some I lifted from IMDb, but a lot of them I lifted myself.
I mean, some of the ones we talked about, so like, you know, Clint Eastwood, he's definitely a reference to this because he's referencing Clint Eastwood. I mean, that's kind of the thing. And that man with no name character he played in the Westerns kind of thing. You know, we can't say Escape from New York without prison movies in general. You know, whether it's Shawshank Redemption, Cool Hand Luke, Brubaker, all of those, I've got a hero or an anti-hero who's put into a prison situation kind of thing.
You said Shawshank and Brubaker?
And Cool Hand Luke. Yep. All three of those.
Okay. Yeah, Cool Hand Luke would be an anti-hero too.
Yes. Because Luke's just doing his own thing and doesn't really care about winning. I mean, the good or the bad of it, he's just doing his thing.
Prison movies. I hadn't really thought about that.
Yeah.
Burt Reynolds used to do somewhat anti-heroes too, didn't he?
True. He did. What was the prison movie with him where he
Longest
was
Longest Yard.
Longest Yard. Yep. That's a good one. Good. That's a good one. Yeah.
That's one of the few that he did that was good. He had a habit of doing bad movies too.
Yep.
All right. I have another James Cameron key in that I totally think James Cameron ripped off the main theme of this for Terminator. When I heard the beginning of this movie, I was like, oh my God, this is that same synth music he uses in Terminator. It is so similar.
Similar, but this has that... Carpenter, a lot of even Carpenter's slow stuff has a very driving undertone beat that it's more like Stranger Things than it is like Terminator, I think.
I'm talking about the opening music in both
films. Yeah, I could hear that melody being similar to the Terminator theme.
I was waiting to see machines rolling over skulls. I was like, this sounds like the same fucking music. And this movie was 3 years prior to that movie. So I think James Cameron borrowed a little bit music-wise.
I could agree with that. Yes. Now that you mentioned it, I can agree with that. Yes.
And then, just for the hell of it, another one is I just saw a note I had. Oh, my God, that giant phone.
Oh, yeah. It's huge. A G.I. Joe phone with a great big antenna.
I forgot about that.
And the technology in general. I mean, even Snake stuff. I mean, the little tracker he's got is, like, huge. And it just has one LED light blinking on it. And then his walkie-talkie thing has a four-foot antenna he pulls out.
Okay, I have another strange key that I'll see if you agree with me, but I'm just going to say two words. Carl Reiner.
Okay.
I think that's his head on the stick that they drive by. I swear to God, every time I see it, I'm like, is that Carl Reiner?
Maybe they got a Carl Reiner face cast from something.
I think they did, man. It looks like Carl Reiner's head on a pike as the Duke's driving by. I can't remember.
Okay.
But
it's
when they're going down onto Broadway.
Yes.
It's that shot.
The new cult.
And there's
the new
tribe. Head on a stick, and I think it's Carl Reiner. So, okay. there are some Mad Max things in this, a lot of Mad Max things. The character of Romero is right out of a Mad Max movie.
Oh,
he could have been Toe Cutter, basically. Just insert him into a George Miller film 2 years prior. However, the whole scene that you hate is Thunderdome.
Thunderdome. Got it.
I mean, you've got the big gladiatorial thing with him and the baseball bats and the giant Andre, the giant whatever that big bald guy's name is. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Mad Max in this movie.
I've got some sci-fi keys, so to speak. I've got several that are in the same reason or the same influence thereof or reference to, which is Gamesters of Triskelion, the movie Fortress, and Star Trek Discovery in the Orion Slave Planets. All of them have either collars or implants that if you get beyond the line, it's going to blow your head off, or it's going to shock you to discipline you, some kind of control system that's around your neck. That's a very sci-fi trope, which works with this movie. Total Recall. It's Total Recall. When they go to Mars, before they go to Mars, there's a cabbie There's a robot cab in Total Recall, and it is, if you watch it, it's heavily based on Ernest Borgnine's character, Cabby, in this movie.
How funny.
Down to the way it talks and the way it moves and wearing a little hat and the way he has this kind of smile the whole time going, I can take you anywhere. I know everything. It's very.
Is this the one with Schwarzenegger? Because I haven't seen the remake.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the one with Schwarzenegger. I have Clockwork Orange because it's almost like an ode to Clockwork Orange. He's trying to set up that this is a lawless, horrible, you know, prison now. And Snake goes downstairs and the first thing he sees is three guys passing a girl around and doesn't do anything about it. But it's kind of like a little, it felt like a little bit of Carpenter doing an homage to Clockwork.
It does. I did not think about that, but you're absolutely right. I think she may have been drugged though, because she wasn't really fighting that much.
Right. But, well, she was trying, but I didn't know if she was either drugged or had already been, you know,
and they
hit.
Were just kind of pushing her around. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was that kind of feel to it.
It was menacing, like rape was intended or something. Yeah, yeah.
I also, another sci-fi one I had was Fantastic Voyage, because we're given, from the very beginning of this, we're given that timeline, you know. And in Fantastic Voyage, they use that horrible clock like we used to have as the old clock radios.
Digital, where, the ones that flip.
The thing would flip down, not digital. It flips down like a car.
Right,
you know? Yeah. And in this one, he's got that wristwatch that he is constantly looking at. You know, oh my God. So.
Oh, that's so funny. Here's one. Well, you know what? I'm going to come back to that one because this one is kind of broad. But here's one that I lifted. Did you know that the model of this city is the one they used in Blade Runner? They just repainted it?
Hmm. No, but that's great trivia to have.
Yeah.
That's kind of
cool.
Yeah.
I thought so, too. They just repainted it, I guess, to make it look more futuristic.
Cool.
Cyberpunk William Gibson credits this film as an influence on his novel Neuromancer.
I could
see
that.
So there's some sci-fi cred for you, because he's a huge sci-fi writer.
Well, and Neuromancer is a great book. Great book.
Yeah. Said he was intrigued by the exchange in one of the opening scenes where the warden says to Snake, you flew the Gulf Fire over Leningrad, didn't you?
Yep.
And he said it turned out to be just a throwaway line, but for a moment it worked. And in the best science fiction, there's usually a casual reference that can imply a lot.
Yep.
So that's why I mean, it told me, oh, that's why they're using him. He knows how to get in.
Yep.
So,
I've got a few. I've got, of course, Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, the zombies in general, because that's what the crazies kind of feel like, even though they're actually more 28 days. They're more faster zombies because they can run, and Snake has to run away from them. But that whole coming out of the sewers and then,
and I guess they're cannibals. Is that why they were after them?
I assume. And then pulling people down under the floor. That's kind of very, you know, zombie-like.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned it before, but just to make it official, Warriors, of course, because it has that feel of going behind enemy lines and having to.
It's so funny that you keep bringing it up, because I'm watching. I'm almost through with the first season of Luke Cage, and there's a lot of Warriors in that, and they even quote the movie. They say, you know, come out to play, and that kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, they know they're doing it. It's not. I mean, it's thoroughly intentional.
Yeah.
And I think it's intentional in this in regards to just time, because, I mean, that movie came out, what, a year earlier, maybe two?
Yeah, I think it was either 79 or 80. Yeah.
Right. And it's Walter Hill. And I always associate Walter Hill and John Carpenter and Dan O'Bannon and all those guys together because of Alien.
You know? Yeah, they're kind of the same kind of clique I always put together, like I put Spielberg, Lucas, Milius. All of them were all the same kind of click, too, kind of thing. Of course, I've got another Western reference, which is True Grit. And I actually read that that's one of the reasons that Kurt Russell wanted the eye patch.
Yeah.
Was he wanted to be that Rooster Cogburn kind of character, John Wayne. And then Robin Hood, too, to an extent. There's this mystique kind of feel to it. to Snake that I wish they'd done a little bit more. Like if they had actually shown his crime or talked about his crime and the fact that maybe, yeah, he robbed a federal prison, but then he gave everything to the poor or, you know, or distributed it and burned it, you know, anti-establishment kind of stuff, that would have been more, even more Robin Hood trope. But this mystique that he has that everybody recognizes him or knows about him or thinks he was dead, you know, kind of thing.
You mentioned his eye patch. I had read something where it was his idea. He surprised John Carpenter by doing it for like his first shot or first take. And Carpenter said, keep it. But then all of a sudden he was like having to take it off a lot because it was fucking with his depth perception.
Of course.
he couldn't see.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it might have been a mistake on his part that he regretted. I don't know.
Well, it was interesting because I started thinking that this time watching it, I was going, why doesn't somebody say to somebody else, sneak up on his left side? He can't see from his left side. You know,
right. Kind of thing. Right. I've got that John Carpenter was inspired by Death Wish.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
That he didn't agree with the film's philosophy, but he liked the way it conveyed the sense that New York City was a jungle.
Yeah.
And that's where you get the fact that Manhattan is a prison. You mentioned John Wayne. But apparently there's a John Wayne movie called Big Jake where every time John Wayne tells someone his name that they say, I thought you were dead.
Okay.
So that was lifted from a Western. And I mean, we know that John Carpenter came from the school of Howard Hawks. I mean, he loved Westerns.
Right.
And he loved Howard Hawks, who did the original Thing from Another World.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this whole movie plays like a Western to me. It really does. Other than the sci-fi aspect, it just feels like a Western.
Well,
and I think that's one of the reasons I like it.
There's lots of Western tropes in it. You know, you're hiring the, quote, gunslinger to go in and do something, whether it's rescue or protect the town or do whatever. He's going into a hostile environment. He's got to do it his own way, no matter what. And then does he get retribution at the end or not, kind of thing. So, yeah, I think it's very Western influenced. I think I've also got, again, another James Bond reference in that, you know, even when before they put the thing in his neck, they're showing that big table of all the gear and stuff, like the walkie-talkie, the wristband, the other wristband, the tracker, and then the other wristband he has, you push this and for 15 minutes we know right where you are. Don't even know the reason for that, but we know it's going to come up later and they're going to use it.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. But that was that very James Bond meets Q. Here's your special tools we just made for this story.
Yeah. You reminded me of another scene I like. I love that scene where he thinks he's found the tracker. And it's.
Oh, yeah. And it's a
rat. And the guy just turns up and goes, I'm the president of the United States. Yeah. Whatever it is he says.
Yeah,
because some guy's hitting him.
They're and beating he's up got, a bum. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just some bum that's wearing the tracker. Yeah.
Right. And then my last one I've got is, I mentioned already, is The Thing. It was one of my first ones. I said, so this is MacReady's evil brother.
Kind of
thing.
A little bit.
Or maybe it's a
hybrid between him and Jack from Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah.
Maybe. I've got a few others. Some I lifted, some I didn't. The Statue of Liberty shots and the concept of that in science fiction has been used in obviously other films like Planet of the Apes.
Of course.
There's another. This is in the concept art. There's something called the Jupiter Menace. There's that movie. I think Jake Gyllenhaal's in it. The Day After Tomorrow.
Yep.
And Cloverfield has a destroyed Statue of Liberty on it as well.
Armageddon.
Right. Does it?
Yeah, Armageddon. They blow the hell out of New York and when it comes back
I know,
after.
I'm talking about poster art, like concept art.
I think Armageddon, doesn't it have it has the White House. It doesn't use the Statue of Liberty shot.
I can't
remember. But there's a Statue of Liberty shot where it's, you know.
I remember them showing meteors going through or asteroids going through buildings in New York. But
Independence Day.
Yeah. That's Washington.
Yeah. That, no, it has it's New York, too.
Okay. Yeah. John Carpenter claims that the 1962 sci-fi novel Planet of the Damned by Harry Harrison was the inspiration behind the plot.
Huh.
The novel is about a man named Brian Brand who is forced to leave his home planet Anihar and goes to hellish planet Dis to prevent a global nuclear holocaust.
Huh.
So that's interesting. So Carpenter was reading some sci-fi when he thought of it.
And, obviously.
And probably smoking a doob and watching the Watergate hearings.
all at once.
Okay. Two last keys. I think these are my last ones. One that I have that is – this is me. This is not IMDb.
Mm-hmm.
There is a heavy – Wizard of Oz theme to me in this movie. It feels like Pliskin goes in and meets these characters, and all of a sudden it becomes one, then two, then three, then four, and then they're trying to get back home.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but I started realizing it when I started saying he's not solo anymore. All of a sudden Brain's with him, and Maggie's with him.
Cabby. Yeah.
And Cabby's with him at the end. And I'm like, Cabby is, you know, the Cowardly Lion. I don't know. Anyway, it gave me a heavy Wizard of Oz vibe.
That's interesting. I never felt that or saw that, but I can see it once you put it in that way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like, you know, what I love about doing this is we end up thinking, I mean, you'll think of it or I'll think of it because I hadn't thought of it before, that kind of thing. And it's a challenge to... it's a challenge. It's a revelation that we see it from a different perspective. We go, oh, wow, that probably was an influence on this.
Oh, I think so highly. And that's why I encourage people out there listening to comment, because you may see something that we don't.
Uh-huh.
Or you know, carelessly overlooked. I don't know. Oh, I just thought of two other things, too. We talked about modern-day anti-heroes, and that immediately makes me think of Breaking Bad or Rick Grimes from The Walking Dead.
Yep.
And they're both modern anti-heroes.
Yes.
Very much so. I mean, Breaking Bad was a huge success. And then Rick Grimes, I mean, that show went on for a decade. So,
mm-hmm.
But lastly, I'm going to close out with the future. I don't know if you know this, but in December of 2016, it was announced that Hollywood would not remake the film, but instead opted to do a prequel set before this film, and it's rumored that Chris Hemsworth will play Snake Plissken, and that the film will co-star Summer Glau.
Oh, wow. Good cast. I mean, it'd be interesting to see, is it going to be Leningrad when he flew the Gulf Cull or whatever? The whatever?
I don't know. I don't, it doesn't say any, I mean, I don't have anything, and that was announced in 2016, and we're in 2022, 6 years later, so who knows?
Right.
You know how things live and die in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But I will say that Nick Castle is also developing a production in Italy called Pliskin.
Mm. Okay.
And Nick Castle's one of the original writers, and if he's going back to their roots and doing it on the cheap, that may be why he's doing it in Italy. I don't know.
Hmm. Interesting. I mean, I know the budget was very low for this. I think for the budget, they accomplished quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you cannot disregard just the novelty of the story itself. An anti-hero with an eye patch is going into Manhattan, which is now a federal prison, to rescue the president. I mean, there's some really coolness to this movie. I do admit that. I just do not think it's executed very well and tends to make some issues.
No. As a matter of fact, it would be kind of cool if they did remake it and address some of those issues, because it could be done.
Yeah, and especially if they took some of the ideas, like what if you did play up a little bit more of the Wizard of Oz kind of element of it? Mm-hmm. That's kind of interesting, you know, if you played up some of the snake character, you know, and gave – to me, it's just giving the characters more worth. I mean, Maggie's character in this really doesn't do anything. she really could. You could, you know, it's that whole Indiana Jones thing or Raiders of the Lost Ark thing. You know, it, you could do this whole movie without her and it wouldn't make a difference.
But I mean, that's just the time. I mean, I don't think it's great, but back then a lot of women were used as props in film.
Agreed, but I think Carpenter learned from that. I mean, the character, like, think of the characters in The Thing. The characters in The Thing have purpose. There's a reason for them. Even, right. You know, Windows and everything, and they all have, there's a reason for them in the plot. In this, it's not really, you know. Right.
And Carpenter is not a misogynist in the fact that with Halloween, I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis is a hero. I mean, yes. She survives. She's not always the smartest. Sometimes she stabs him in the neck and then runs and doesn't, you know, stab him 100 times more.
Well, Barbeau's character in The Fog. Great character. Well,
she's great. She can't leave, but she's keeping everybody in connection with her radio show.
Correct.
Yeah,
correct.
For sure.
So,
but
again,
they, you know, they have Tom Atkins saving Jamie Lee Curtis. Or what have you.
But again, but anyway. For a Christmas Carpenter or a Carpenter Christmas kickoff, this has been good.
Oh, know? I know. Absolutely. And our 150th episode. I mean, wow. What better way to go back to John and Kurt, you know?
Yeah, 150.
I know. Well, I guess that's going to do us for today. We'd like to thank you for joining us. We hope you had a good Thanksgiving. Christmas is around the corner, but yes. We've got two more shows that we're going to do before then. Two more Carpenter shows that you'll know about sooner than later. Our other shows are still broadcasting on YouTube. If you haven't checked them out yet, good Lord, how do I name them all? We have one that's coming attractions called Coming to Get You. We have Shudder with Tim, where I talk about movies we've watched on Shudder. David and I have been doing top fives about our favorite things, whether they're characters, movies, or tropes in sci-fi and horror. And if that's not enough, then you can always jump over to Patreon and help sponsor us by watching our shows on Star Trek and the X-Files.
Yes.
Jesus Christ. We got a lot going on.
We love doing it, and we love you guys supporting us and following us, listening to us week after week. We really appreciate it.
We do. And until next week, I'll see you then.
See you then.
All righty. Bye.